Even if you have the superhero mentality of it won't be me, you better think twice and you better look when you leave home who's standing there waiting for you to come back. If you have a spouse, if you have kids, if you have parents, because a lot of times nowadays we have a 3-4 level household with parents, grandparents, and kids all in the same house. Those people are depending on you. Please go home tonight.
Hey guys, if you missed out on the last conference in Nashville, Tennessee, you don't want to miss out on the next one. It's April 28th through May 3rd, Orlando, Florida, the Gaylord Palms Resort and Convention Center. You made a mistake missing the last one. You don't want that to happen again on this one. 5 days of some of the best training you're ever going to experience packed into one event. We have an early bird special right now, $50 off. Use 24 early bird on our website, streetcop.com. Look for the conference, click the link, register today. If you want to get significantly better at this profession in 5 days, don't dare miss out on the 2024 Street Cop Conference.
111.
Hey guys, welcome to this episode of the Street Cop Training Podcast. I'm founder and CEO of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Benito, and we have with us one of our Street Cop survivors from our Street Cop Survivor group. If you are somebody who is injured significantly in the line of duty, or you know somebody who is significantly injured, shot, maimed, I mean, the price of admission is not a good price to actually be able to pay. But the reality is it's been a group for folks who were the victims of something significant in the line of duty. And it has really done a lot for people. It's just a community of police officers who were really put through the ringer of physical and mental pain and have found a lot of camaraderie amongst each other. So, you know, it's available. They have to vet you, but we'd love to have you in the group. And that's what it's designed for. We really don't say many hard no's. That's what it's designed for. But today we have one of those members, and it's Kevin Angelilli. And I appreciate you taking the time out of your day to do this, Kev. And so maybe you can give everybody a little context of who you are, where you're from, how you got into law enforcement, and some of that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's great. My name's Kevin Angelilli, and I got in civilian law enforcement in 1990. I joined a very large department and worked there for about a year and moved on. And I went to a smaller department and had much more fun and lots of good things. Law enforcement was my dream. I always was the kid that grew up wanting to be a cop, wanting to be out on the road and doing all those fun things. It seemed like fun and adventurous, and it was. I had a good time.
Yeah. How many years did you get in 1990? That's, you know, probably most of our listeners were born in 1999, 2001, right? Date yourself
there. Faithful, I know. Yeah. You know, so the long story short was I have some full-time active duty. I've got part-time and I've got reserve time. I also did some teaching through FDLE in Florida when I was down there. And my overall total years of service is roughly 30. But it's not the 30 that everybody wants. I did not stay full time. There was a time after my incident that I couldn't due to knee injuries. My ankles, feet, knees, hips are all full of arthritis. And it's very stiff, very hard to move and walk at times. And that's why I moved to Florida for a long time. Felt better and everything was good, but you know, one of the side effects of a good law enforcement career is divorce. And after two divorces, I ended up moving again. So I did about 8 years full-time active duty that everyone would consider true law enforcement time. I did multiple years on part-time staff with different agencies. Sometimes it would be as little as a once every 6 months, just to stay active, you know, wink, wink, nod, nod. But it was not a full 30 with a retirement plan. And that was the one thing that I absolutely can say hurts the most coming up on hitting the double nickel birthday, being 55, still working hard and dealing with all the injuries still. So, yeah, you know, for me, I got out for a while, got back in. Had a great run, really did. Worked for some of the best people I've ever met in my life and loved it. It was a great time.
So what happened?
What happened? Well, there I was, you know, as we always start a good story. I worked at a small town called Marmette, West Virginia, Marmet, just outside of the state capital of Charleston by about 3, 4, 5 miles, depending on which route you take. A small, sleepy town. Back in 1990, it was very full, bustling. We had 2 furniture stores for a tiny town. It was actually one of the most sought after little side towns, you know, out on the outskirts of Charleston. And it was fun. We had the normal, you know, minor crime, little thing here and there. Back in the 90s, you know, a joint was considered a big bust. Not like the way it is today. And about 3 o'clock every morning, I'd meet up with the guys from the ambulance company next door, and we'd all go down to the gas station and get a coffee, hang out, shoot the bull, and have a good time. So there I am, August 29th, normal, 3 o'clock, let's go. So I go out, hop in the car, and as I'm going across the parking lot, this guy runs up to my car and starts screaming, and I'm like, calm down, you know, what's going on? He tells me, my girlfriend is trying to run me over. Okay, cool. I don't see anybody. Nobody on the streets. She finally comes around this corner, and he says, that's her. She was trying to run me over. I said, you know, just step behind my car. Let me see if I can get her to pull over, and we'll try to talk to her. So she gets close. I light it up, turn on the blue lights. She cruises on by, so I pull out to pull her over. She doesn't stop. So I, of course, hit the siren, you know, call in on the radio, hey, I'm gonna do this. Well, the guys from the ambulance company next door, they pull out right in front. They're my friends. They stop. So the ambulance stops. She pulls up behind them and stops. I block her in. Go up, start tapping on the window. She won't open the window. Death grip on the steering wheel, just looking straight ahead. So the guys in the ambulance think, I'm standing next to the car. Everything's good. They pull up about 20, 30 feet, and I start flashing my flashlight at them, and they stop. And the paramedic jumped out. Well, of course, it's an old diesel ambulance. So I run up and I tell him, hey, man, I don't know what's going on. But, you know, this guy says his girlfriend's trying to run him over. She stops. She won't roll down the window to talk to me. And I look back. She has pulled up behind the ambulance again. But now she's backing up. And she's coming around to pass. 2-lane road. We had 1 lane block. She's going opposite direction. So I grab the medic, throw him back in the ambulance, and realize I got no chance of getting in his truck on his lap. So I got to go the other way and get across the street. So as I try to get across the street, she's absolutely accelerating high speed, punching it, flooring it, whatever you guys want to call it. And I'm fast, but I wasn't fast enough. She hit me in the knees. It caught, basically spun the inside of my left knee. Spun me, you know, everybody's favorite term now is ragdoll. I, at some point, my head bounced off the windshield, I guess the windshield, A post, whatever. And I ended up on the ground and she took off. So as I remember, I thought it seemed pretty fast at the time that I rolled up and got up and jumped in my car, but it may have taken a little longer than I expected. I got in my car, passed the ambulance, got into a chase again. Eventually, she pulled into a bar that was pretty close by that she worked at. And she thought, you know, that'd be like safe ground. So I ended up pinning her car in after doing a couple donuts in the parking lot and throwing up some dust and people thinking we were crazy. And I, of course, was on the radio calling for help. And as it was back in those days, you were on your own. It was not a big area. My closest backup was probably 20, 30 minutes away. And that's if somebody heard me and was on the scanner and came to help. So I eventually block her car in and she still hasn't rolled down the window. I realize the passenger door is unlocked. So I go around, open the door, grab her. She does a death grip on the wheel. We do that fun little fight thing to let go of the wheel, get her out of the car and, you know, affect the arrest. Yeah, there was a little scuffle in between, and she went from passively not fighting to actually swinging at me and all that fun stuff. And of course, in that moment, you know, your adrenaline is sky high. I didn't realize how injured I truly was.
So what was the backstory with the boyfriend and her, and who was she?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I forgot the backstory. This is the fun part. They were boyfriend, girlfriend, and they had gotten into an argument. She was the bartender at this local bar where she pulled in. And basically, she had a temper. And, you know, she was going to kill him. And she actually had tried to run him down in the road, but he ran and hopped a fence so she couldn't hit him. And he dodges through some backyards and came to the police station. Well, eventually I go to find him. He had seen her hit me and then disappeared into the night. So it took quite a while for us to track this guy down because, of course, she wasn't going to give up her witness as to the guy who was she was trying to run over in the first place. So it ended up being a longer bit of a story to try to get him to show up and actually say, yeah, this is what happened. And she was trying to run him over. But, you know, they eventually broke up, which is, I guess, good for him.
What happened to her criminally?
Well, that night, I, of course, arrested her. And, you know, believe it or not, this was back in the day when you took people to magistrate court and you hand wrote your criminal complaints. So, you know, I know it's all computerized now and it's a lot more fun. But I went back and did the processing and the judge said, you know, you're going to have a $5,000 bail. And she reached into her purse and pulled out a stack of $100 bills and counted them out till she hit 5,000.
Wow. How did she have that kind of money?
That we never figured out. But apparently it was from the bar. It may have been the whole night's cash or whatever. There was suspicion that she was dealing on the side and had potentially been selling drugs and had that money from the sale of drugs. But again, we never found out, but she was charged with attempted murder of me, attempted murder of her boyfriend, but he would not stand up and say that's what happened. So he wouldn't testify. I charged her with DUI, all that kind of fun fleeing. But back then it wasn't actually the felonies like it is now. When it all boiled down, she ended up pleading out to DUI and time served. Now, here's the kicker. Even back then, you had a 24-hour minimum for DUIs. When the judge offered her time served, it was the time she spent with me while I arrested her, processed her, and took her to magistrate court.
Wow.
Yep.
So is that the plea agreement she agreed to? And why did they go so light on her?
Yeah, that's a great question. I wish I had that answer. I do. But, you know, it works mysteriously. We can all have our suspicions and ideas. But if you have $5,000 cash in your wallet the night you're arrested, you can kind of guess where money goes and have your speculations. And it leads to bad nights when you think about all those things. I eventually went to the hospital. And, you know, I woke up the next day, my knee was bigger than my thighs, and I had had to have knee surgery on my left knee. I had both my ankles, were pretty much everything was sprained from waist down, both my hips, knees, ankles. I spent 6 months off of work, thanks to physical therapy. Give a shout out to all the physical therapists out there. Appreciate them. They got me back to walking. The joys of 6 months of therapy was not a lot of fun. And that's honestly where the story goes from the bad side to the worst was I see a lot of folks these days, and I really am happy for the officers who have a supportive department that helps you, is there for you, and does for you. In the 6 months that I was off, I received two phone calls from my police department, and they were both from my friend who was a patrolman. And hey buddy, how you doing? And I said, you know what, I'm alive, I'm getting better. Well, the chief wanted me to ask you how soon you're coming back. And that was both calls. Not hey buddy, do you need a ride to physical therapy? It was my left knee. It was in a big cast. I had two cars, both of them stick shift. I couldn't drive. The only way I could get to physical therapy was if my ex took me or one of the neighbors. And it was very, very tough. Not only did I have to battle with my department, they eventually told me that the chief had put me in for an award, and it had gone to the mayor, who refused to sign it. And when we asked why do you not want your policemen to get awards for injuries in the line of duty, he said, "I don't want anybody to know that any of my guys got hurt." Now, the kicker of the story, there's a bunch, really. How I got the job in the first place was one of the other officers was on a arrest, and it was a domestic upstairs, as always. And he arrests one of the people. As they go down the stairs, the person he didn't arrest jumps on his back, and the three of them roll down metal stairs, and it broke his back. So he was off for multiple years, was medically retired, and never came back. So while I worked in Marmet, even though I worked full-time hours, I was never full-time because that slot was held by the other officer, and they couldn't give his full-time slot until he was medically retired or he came back to work. And that was the reason I never got full-time there. So that eventually led to me department job hunting. And I found another department that would hire me full-time, give me benefits and all that kind of good stuff. And, you know, it went downhill from there.
In what sense did it go downhill from there?
Well, after that, the first big winter hit after being back to work, and it was extremely hard. You know, they told me arthritis would be 5, 6, 7 years out, and it wasn't. It was immediate that I had basically the way the arthritis grows, it makes it your knees grind. And I was in a partial cast, one of the rubber sleeves you put on and off that had metal rods down the side of it. And, you know, I walked with a severe limp. And that's when my new department decided, maybe we don't need you. Maybe we don't want somebody who walks the way you do. Maybe we don't want somebody with a history of being hurt in the line of duty. So they started the process of forcing me out is probably the best way to do it. The whole time one of the big things that you always want to have is not just departmental support, but family support. I did not get that. My family turned and basically said to me, you know, look what happened. You could have died. You could have died. You should get out now. And that's all I heard every day. You should get out. You should quit. Oh my God, we can't believe you're going back to that. Why do you do this job? You know, you could get killed. Look what happened. You could have been killed. And it was very negative. I was very much being forced out by my family and then feeling forced out by the job because they're like, well, you can't wear that brace on duty anymore. Really? How am I supposed to walk? Well, we don't know, but you know, you can't do that anymore. We don't want you doing this. We don't want you doing that. And it basically became, you need to go. So eventually, we had a little sit down meeting, and off the record as things used to be, no extra cameras or microphones. And they just said, look, you know, we don't want you here. We don't want anybody that can't walk right, can't run right. So we'll give you a couple weeks and you need to find a new job. And that's when I got out.
Where did you go?
Well, at that point, I went into pretty much everything I could do, anything I could do. A good friend of mine was managing restaurants. So I started managing restaurants for a year. And the one good thing I can say about the other department I went to, without using a name, was we had a robbery of a store, and they had some guns stolen. It was a pawn shop, and the guns were, a bunch of kids took them and took them down by the river, threw them in the water. So they shot up all the ammo they had, threw them in the river. They came around and they're like, hey, is anybody good at swimming? And I said, man, years ago I did this scuba thing. So I became the dive team. And that's where my change of career really happened. I started scuba, went all the way to instructor, and started learning about, at that time it was called police diver, and it's now public safety diving. I've been diving since like 1994. I went all the way to become an instructor trainer. I was one of the first people that actually taught public safety diving, police diving, and made it better. It used to be people would do one class and I'm a policeman, I'm a diver, and off they'd go. And that's where I really made a name for myself. And throughout those years, I'd be picked up by a different department to be a reserve officer, reserve deputy, work part-time somewhere. And that's how I kept my foot in the door of law enforcement. And I've trained people from all over the U.S., all over the world. Wrote a book, Public Safety Diving, All the Way to the Bottom. And it's one of the books that I use to teach. It used to be called Florida Keys Community College, but now it's College of the Keys. I used to live in Key Largo, Florida, and taught public safety diving down there as well for FDLE, Florida Department of Law Enforcement. And it was great. You get to know people, and it was my happy place, my happy thoughts of keeping it safe and keeping it going. Then after I had a divorce a few years back, I ended up actually going back to Marmette PD for another year, just to see if I could do it, just to hang with the guys. And there's a few there that remembered me, that remembered what had happened, and trying to get it all kind of put back together. Then luckily I met my wife, and she's from Tennessee, so I'm from Tennessee. But you know, it's got its good sides and bad sides to the whole stories of everything. And there was quite a bit of time that I wouldn't talk about this. And people would notice I walk with a limp and ask why. And doesn't matter, didn't talk about it. And then, you know, after finding you guys on Street Cop Survivor Club and following along and getting vetted and getting approved into the group, I saw you guys had posted. It's been 30 years. It's time. And it's been a long, drawn out story. I tell everybody, if you're in a situation and your department doesn't give you the backing you want or need, keep trying, because it can happen. I'm looking at, the chief that's there now in Marmette is a good old friend of mine that actually took over my job when I left. And he went into the part-time position and full-time, and now he's the chief, which is great. Good friend, Chuck Butcher. He's working with me. I'm pulling the old newspaper articles, and we're going to once again apply and see if we can't get the awards through the National Police Officers Association in Florida, and see if they'll approve it. If for nothing else, you know, Purple Heart. For me, I think it was pretty cool to get back up, continue the chase, not let the bad guys ever get away. You know, that was what we did back in those days. Nobody got away, but they did. Every now and then.
When you go into police diving, I want to switch it just a little bit because I have a question about that. Inevitably, I'd imagine most of the time you're looking for bodies.
Yes.
I'd imagine sometimes you're looking for evidence, but most of the time you're looking to recover bodies.
Yes.
What's that like?
Well, the honest answer is most of the time you're in water that you can't really see. And when you're in this environment, basically you're relying on all of your gear to basically support you, keep you alive. And you can't see anything. It just walk into a black room and play Helen Keller. You go down to the bottom, swish your arms out in front of you, side to side. And if you're lucky, you've got 3, 4, 5 people in a row, and we all line up shoulder to shoulder and try to do the sweep and see if we can't find the missing body. Sometimes it doesn't have to be crime related. When it comes to public safety diving, you have people that just swimming and drown. It can be a boating accident. It can be any kind of accident. And what you're doing is providing that comfort to the family of bringing that lost person home. And it is so amazing, the feeling that you get when you actually do bring somebody out and give them back to their family. What's it like underwater? Man, I'll tell you what, first couple of times, it's surprising, shocking. You're scared to death because you can't see anything. And then, unfortunately, I've come up and been sweeping side to side and had a face right in my face.
Ooh.
Yeah. I was in a dry suit, but when I was done, it wasn't always dry.
Yeah. So what was that like? You're like, you know, what was that moment when that's something like that happens?
It's definitely the, shoot moment. But yeah, it'll make you jump. It's very, very.
So what do you do when you grab when you finally recover a missing person or a body? How do you guys recover at that point, that person?
Even though let's start with something very simple where somebody went missing swimming and they were known to be swimming or drinking and swimming or whatever, and it's not considered a crime. You have to treat it as a crime. So if you can get photos, videos, and clear enough water before you get the body out, you need to do so. You also need to search all the way around them in case it was a crime scene. You know, there's nothing worse than pulling out a body and then finding a bullet hole. So, and that does happen. But basically, we use different types of techniques to get the body out. And one of them is honestly a body bag. We take one in the, we find the body, we send up a surface marker buoy, and then there's a support diver who will swim over, come straight down, and give us the body bag. We put the body into the bag, seal it up so the water can drain. It's got holes in it, but major evidence won't get away from you. Then, of course, you hook them to a lift bag, which is a big balloon underwater, fill it up with air, and it takes them up. Then you of course, get them to shore. If you've got family there, all that kind of stuff, that's where the fun begins of trying to keep everybody away. If it's new, if it's on the news, you're going to have news. You're going to have drones flying around. And, you know, you're trying to protect a little bit of the deceased's dignity. At the same time, you know, you're trying to solve a case. And if you work real well with your local ambulance crews, you know, I ended up getting into EMS for over 20 years and was a paramedic and did all that fun thing of pronouncing people dead, that you do have all these outside forces working against you, which is not just, some of it's helpful if they've got drone footage or if they've got a good video coverage of it. But at the same time, you don't want mom to witness her child being pulled out of the water dead.
Right.
So yeah, there's a lot that goes into it. And that's what I've worked with many, many departments over, like I said, all across the country and even around the world with the better way of doing things.
Is there any one or two cases that really stick out for you, which I'm sure they are? I'm sure people ask you this, but I'm going to be your kindergartner asking that question.
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, one of the best and one of the funniest ever was we had the story itself of what happened. This guy was fishing. And of course, you know, as the rule goes, you can't go fishing without a 12 pack. And he is getting done with his fishing day and ends up getting a snag. He's good and drunk. So as he's reeling in his rod, he falls into the water. He fell straight in, couldn't swim. His girlfriend's there. She couldn't swim. So they call the dive team. Cool. We get to the scene within, you know, 20 minutes, and we're like, hey, we've got a shot at this. And then they tell us, by the way, the guy went underwater more than an hour and a half ago.
Oh, wow.
And we're like, wait a minute, what happened? Well, they called the fire department to see if he had gone missing and had walked away. When the witness had says, hey, no, he fell in. I watched him. He went in the water. He never came up. He's right there. So the fire department does a search and says, no, we can't find him. Maybe we should call the dive team. Not cool. So we show up. I just trained these guys. They were good friends of mine. And very, very funny guys. And I ended up with two divers. And I said, all right, guys, look, here's what happened. He's right here. He's not 10 feet out of this. So they get in the water, come around. And I, you know, really, and they're pretty excited. They're hyperventilating. I'm like, all right, calm down. Just go down right here. Relax for a minute underwater and then start your search and swim into shore. You're going to find him. So, of course, I'm watching their bubbles, and they go down, and they calm down. They go about 5 feet, and there's lots of bubbles. I mean, just tons and tons and tons of bubbles. These guys come to the surface. One diver's holding on to the other diver's hand, and he says, "I found him." The other diver goes, "That's my hand." So I, of course, laugh, and I'm like, "Guys, let's not do that. Let's go down, find our missing person." So they go down. Same guy reaches out, and he finds the hand. So he reaches over to his buddy again, and his buddy's, you know, just because you can't really say anything underwater. And I see all the bubbles going. I'm like, "Oh, this is not good." So the first guy takes his partner's hand, shows him my right hand, my left hand, one more hand, lots more bubbles. That's when they had found the missing person. So it's not exactly funny, but it is kind of fun that things like that happen because they were in zero visibility. They couldn't see anything, which is also one of the biggest problems that we have. Lots of standouts of looking for guns, which is always a great thing. Knives, murder weapons, and finding them. And one of the coolest is I had found some guns that had been used, multiple guns. And we went in and they had this smug young fellow. And he's sitting there with his arms crossed, "You got nothing on me," kind of a guy. And I come walking in with wearing my swim trunks and a beach towel. Plunked down two rifles and a handgun. And he went white. "Where did you find my guns?" And I'm like, "Sweet, we're done here." He just confessed because he said, "My guns." He said he didn't do it. He had no idea.
So were those guns used in a homicide?
Yeah. Yeah, it was a murder case where he'd actually shot and killed his wife. So we had another one where a guy shot his wife, but put a decorative throw pillow over her face and then shot her, which, of course, messes up the residue on the face because there's the residue of the gunpowder went into the pillow. But what he didn't realize, part of the pillow went into her face.
Oh, wow.
Yes. So what he does is he takes this decorative pillow and the gun that he used, stacks them on top of each other, puts them in a huge Ziploc baggie with a brick, tosses it out into a little lake behind his house. It was a pond. It was really nasty. And we eventually got called in and they said, "We think he might have thrown this gun in here." And we're like, "Okay, well, how do you know?" "Well, you know, the neighbor saw something kind of suspicious and they think whatever." So we went out and pond's maybe a 100-yard circle. So it was actually a big search for two people. And I'm swimming around and I come across this bag. I'm like, "What is this? This can't be, I have no idea what this is." So I'm sitting there for a few minutes. I said, "I'll just go up and look," and go up and pick it up. And there's like mud and debris coming off of it. And I look and I can clearly see the gun and it's the pillow and the weight to hold it all down. So yeah, he went to prison for life.
Hey guys, follow us on all social media platforms to include Instagram, Twitter, Facebook group. We have so much information going out every single day, and we don't want you to miss out on any of that stuff. So check it out. Go give us a follow.
That was the part. That was the fun part. That it has been the fun part, and I still teach public safety diving, so it's a lot of fun.
What about encountering wildlife in your dives?
Living in Florida, I've been scuba diving and seen alligators that have stayed above us. They don't bother us, luckily. I do know several dive teams in Florida that do take their SWAT snipers in case gators decide they want to get close, too close. Large catfish. And one of the problems that you do have with a deceased anything in the ocean or in a lake, pond, quarry where there are fish, they do destroy evidence and they do create additional wounds and marks on the bodies that you eventually have to account for. And that's where your forensics comes into play and they can figure it out. But no, not really. I mean, I do have videos on my webpage of petting sharks, playing with the sharks, and I got engaged to my wife on a shark dive. So it was cool. We were feeding sharks. But during actual dives? No. Nah. They haven't come to bother us on recoveries or anything. But in the ocean, you do sometimes have crabs that are doing what they do. It is what it is. Anything that's in the ocean that's biologic will get eaten. And it's very rough. It's something you have to have a hard stomach for. And you've got to understand when you find people, there's no, I'll just say it the way it is. When you find somebody who's been dead in warm water, in either the ocean or a lake or a river or whatever, the body condition deteriorates rather quickly. When you get crabs, fish, whatever, that start picking at it and eating at it, it can be extremely disturbing. And if you're working with other folks who are not ready for that, you need to have that preparation conversation and say, look, here's what can happen. We have pictures, videos that we show of recoveries, and not everybody can handle it. And it's kind of one of those things that the public safety diving is not always for everyone, even just from that standpoint, let alone anything else.
What advice do you have for, I would say, both law enforcement and non-law enforcement regarding what you've seen as a diver and with your recovery efforts? Like, what are some things you could say like, hey, clearly this is a really bad idea, and this is where we're seeing, rescue attempts that were failed, or this is what we see overall and how people end up in situations like this. I mean, you know, we had a guy that I didn't know him, but I had a lot of friends who knew him. And I think about this story a lot because it was right near where I grew up. And so in the bay where I grew up, there's a lot of industry. So I think the ocean floor is pretty mucked up pretty badly. And so the story goes that I believe the guy was working on his outboard engine, and the outboard engine somehow slips off, hits the bottom. So he goes down to go get it, right? He puts his swim trunks on. He's going to run down and lift it up and get it out of the water and drag it out. And what he ends up doing is, well, as he lifts it, he sinks his feet in. It's like cement. He can't move.
Yep.
I think about that one a lot, and like how the sentiment on the bottom of the ocean is a big variable in some of these efforts. So what are a few things that maybe you could pass along to people about what you've seen and maybe some wisdom you can give to everybody?
Absolutely. I'd love to. Number one, you can contact me, tristarscuba.com. You can look at my book, Public Safety Diving All the Way to the Bottom. Beyond that, if you're not in an area where I can get to you, get as much training as you can. You know, one of the things I make is a challenge coin, and it lists on there the classes you need to have to do this properly. I made a huge diving career for myself by working with dive teams that got basically their first class of diving. It's called open water diver. Yay, you're the dive team. Go do it. You can't. Because you need to have a dry suit if it's cold, or just the protection. It's just like anything. If we spill oil or gasoline from a car, it's a hazmat. We all know we've been with the lawnmower or the weed eater or whatever, and you got gas on your hand, you wipe your face, and all of a sudden it's on fire. If you go underwater into a contaminated area, that's touching you. If you think a wetsuit is going to protect you, it won't. It'll actually eat through a wetsuit and it'll fall apart. Maybe not today, but in days, it'll fall apart. So you need a dry suit. You need a full face mask. The full face mask encapsulates your face. The dry suit covers from your head to your hands to your feet. And it's all encapsulated. It's a full hazmat. My other background is I also put in about 16 years as a volunteer firefighter. So I've got the police, fire, EMS, plus 30 years of diving. And I've got a well-rounded hazmat background for this. The last thing you want to do is get yourself hurt. We know that from everything, police, fire, EMS. You don't go in and, oh, I'm going to be rescue man. No, that was cool back in the 80s, 90s, whatever. We don't do that now because you can get hurt so bad. Oh, I'll just jump right in and do this. Don't do it. If you're not properly trained, don't even set your foot in the water. If you don't have the proper equipment, don't try this at home. You need to have the correct tanks, the correct backups. You need to have all the training in place. I was the first person that I know of that actually took the five levels of hazmat: awareness, operations, technician, officer, and specialist, and applied it to public safety diving. And just for this reason, to prevent people from trying to do it. Because I would go and find teams that had gotten a grant for $100,000, and they bought a truck and a trailer, and they put strobe lights on the whole thing, and they put rescue. We're rescue. And you're not. You're 99% of the time recovery. And I go through that very much in detail. And you really shouldn't be in that thought process that I have to run and this is rescue. Now, if that's your assignment and you have the training, the equipment, the abilities to do that, and there are agencies out there who do that kind of dive training, then you can say you are. But if you're not, don't do it. Because there's so much that you need to know. You know, to be a true public safety diver, you probably should have open water, advanced open water, rescue diver, plus at least five specialties, because you're going to be in dark water, you're going to be in contaminated water, and you better be able to wear the right equipment.
Yeah, we did a post not too long ago, and essentially, you know, we gave the advice of, you know, the first biggest thing you need to know about water rescue is to not get in the water. It's really the goal of top priority. And unfortunately, every year we see a lot of law enforcement and first responders losing their lives trying to employ rescues. And so I would offer that, maybe think about what that's going to look like beforehand before you attempt to endure that, and try to exhaust every other means possible. We know the time is of essence, but sometimes you might have to just swallow the pill that one life lost is better than two lives lost. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we see these videos of these cops literally going in to do water rescues in full regalia, right?
Yeah.
Tack vest, full duty rig, full pants, full shirt. And so I've really been voicing my thoughts on that of like, guys, I mean, if you want to do that, try it at home first and make sure you have a friend there with a stick, you know, who can make sure he gets you out of the pool. Because you're going to find that going into water with gear on is a really bad idea. We get to do it in the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. They actually had, we did some training where like somebody push you into water, you turn around, you come out, you draw your gun as you come out of the water. But overall, we got to feel what it felt like to be a police officer with a uniform on in water. And I got to tell you, for me, I know that I'm going in my underwear if I have to go in.
Oh,
right? Like, that's it.
I agree. And for anybody who's listening to us and you're, I can do that, I can swim. Cool. Go weigh all of the gear that you wear and realize how much your tack vest weighs with the plates or just whatever level of vest you have on. Weigh your gun belt, weigh your taser, weigh every piece of equipment, especially that doggone radio, and then grab a cinder block, because that's what you got. I mean, really, cinder block's 20 pounds. You probably have more weight than that. I know I used to, you know, have a thigh rig, and I'd have two or three sets of cuffs, and then I have my vest, and I had all this junk. Now get it wet. Then try to swim, because you don't realize how those shoulder pieces cover your shoulders, how it restricts your movement, how much your boots weigh when they're full of water.
Yeah.
How hard it is to kick with a pair of boots. And it's, look, I understand, been there, done that, man. I can tell you stories of, I'm a volunteer firefighter, I know what I'm doing, I'll go into a burning building. And again, you know as well as I do, we have people do it every year. They get a hero award. We have other people every year, they get a very nice funeral. Don't be that one that ends up in a funeral. And it is the toughest thing in the world to do. You know, I had a murder by arson case where we knew the lady was in the house and I could not get in. I tried. I couldn't get to the windows. I couldn't get through the back door. There was actually a couch up against the back door, so it wouldn't open. And when we found her, she was within 3 feet of the back door. So you have a choice, and it's tough. And I would honestly rather sit here and say, gee, what if I would have gone into that house? Well, I would have ended up next to her, dead. But at the same time, I can sit here and say that. I can sit here and say, no, don't jump in the water. It's not worth your life. Even if you have the superhero mentality of it won't be me, you better think twice and you better look when you leave home, who's standing there waiting for you to come back. If you have a spouse, if you have kids, if you have parents, because a lot of times nowadays we have a 3-4 level household with parents, grandparents, and kids all in the same house. Those people are depending on you. Please go home tonight. You know, I got hit by a car and yeah, my family went overboard on it. It could have killed you, blah, blah, blah. And they're right. Had I been a half a second slower, had my foot gone under the car instead of ragdolling over it. Yeah. Had I spun and my head gone under the back tire, totally different story, totally different story. And, you know, I see it on, you know, Street Cop Survivors. We've got people that got shot, bullet missed this by so many inches. What if it wouldn't have? And then to take an unnecessary risk of going into a burning building when fire department's 2 minutes away, when maybe a fire truck shows up and they've got ropes, go back to, if it's in water, throw, row, go, throw something, get in the boat and row to it before you get in the water yourself. Because once you realize you've got all that weight on you of all of your gear, trying to swim plus the stress, okay, cool, you made it there. Let's say you actually get there and grab that person. How hard do you now have to work to get out? What is your physical reserve? What do you have left? How much gas do you have in your tank to get you out? Oh, but now you have another person. What if they're panicked? And instead of trying to, oh, Dennis, save me, they decide, I'm going to climb you, which is the most common panic. It's an active panic response of climbing the ladder. They actually physically climb with their hands and their feet to get on top of you to get out of the water. Sure. If your feet touch, great. I'll stand up. Cool. Great story. What if it doesn't? You know, everybody always wants the miracles. Sure. I can Google and search the internet and I can show you where this boat capsized and this guy was in an air pocket for 3 days. When the diver came through, the victim reached down and touched the diver. Could you imagine that? Boy, that'd be a shock. But he was in an air pocket. Nobody knew. We talk about cars with air pockets in the back windows. Sometimes when it's curved, it'll have an air pocket. There's several stories out of Florida. People go into a canal. They're not completely submerged. So that back glass is an air pocket. If they're in an air pocket, how quickly do you need to be in there? Can you go without gear? What are you going to do, break the glass? Okay, you broke the glass. Now their air is gone. Whoops. Now what? Do you have the gear to get them out? Are they going to get cut up? Are they going to pull you? If you break that glass and they can get a hold of you, they're going to hold you with them until they can't hold you any longer. These are the things that you don't think about beforehand. That's why you got to think about them before. It's like anything else. When you get into SWAT, when you get into tactical EMS, when you get into all this stuff, that's where you start the what-if games. Hopefully, if you have a good training officer, they start it from day one. All right, what are you going to do if we're driving and this car pulls out in front of you? That's the first thing, defensive driving. The next thing becomes, well, okay, what if a bad guy call comes out where the person with a gun, how are we going to approach? What are we going to do? How are you going to take cover? We got to do this, the same things with water and water safety, because it is that important. The last thing you want to do is go, and especially when it's cold. I mean, I can tell you story after story of being up north, and we used to do a New Year's Day dive. It was fun, and all the guys, we'd go hang out, and all the girls would come along, and we'd wear our dry suits and get in the ice, break the ice, go diving. Not really the smartest thing, but it was fun. And I remember we were doing it 1 year, and this guy, these two divers are practicing a rescue. On New Year's Day, it's snowing. There's ice on the water, a little bit of thin ice, and they're breaking through it. And I was like, okay, I start looking around. I'm like, is anybody doing a class? And everybody starts looking around. I said, does anyone know those divers? And they had panicked from the bottom and bolted to the surface. And they were panicking, trying to get out of the water. So I ended up running down. I took my fins with me. Smart idea. I was in a dry suit. Put on my fins and jumped in. No mask. No gloves. When I hit the water, mind you, I'm an instructor at the time. I've probably got 500 to 1,000 dives under my belt. I know what I'm doing. Midair, I roll on my back, cover my face, and I'm like, ooh, this is going to hurt. The water was so cold, it felt like my hands were on fire. It burned. I swim out, grab the one guy that's the most panicked, drag him in. We go to take his gear off at the dock. My hands were so cold, I couldn't get them to close. And I had to be helped out of the water. That's me. I'm supposed to know what I was doing. Again, this is, 25 years ago. This would have been probably January of 99. January 1st of 99.
Yeah. I was almost graduating high school, just so you know. June, I think it was 25th, I graduated class from my high school.
That hurts.
Don't feel bad. Listen, we talked to the people in this office who were in their early 20s. And I mean, they haven't even seen movies like Something About Mary and any Austin Powers movies. It's pretty wild.
Yeah. Oh, Lethal Weapon. You got to go back and watch the classics and see the brick, the whole car battery that Danny Glover has. And it's a cell phone. And then you realize, wait, this was filmed in 1987.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yeah.
So it's good stuff. But, lots of those things where you got to be careful because it is so very dangerous. And, my story started with another night. Let's go get a coffee. It's 3 a.m. It's our meeting time. We solve the problems of the world and shoot the bull and talk about what was on TV, football games and whatever. And, a second later, you're changing your career path, your entire life, because somebody made a poor decision on their end and I had to pay for it. So still walk with a limp. Gets worse in the cold weather. And a couple times a year, I remember. And honestly, for anybody who's contemplating coming on to the podcast, do it. I didn't sleep very well last night. It was a hard time getting to sleep. I've been thinking about this since we set it up. And the best thing I can tell you is I've looked forward to talking to you and telling you my story and what happened and everything that went wrong. And hopefully one person will hear this and come forward and say, here's what happened to me. In my selfish way, I want my awards, damn it. I want to be recognized because I never got the retirement. I never got the recognition. And after a few months, nobody even wanted to talk to me about it. Oh, you're back. Oh, okay. Nobody'd ask. Talk to the people. Get the awards that you deserve. Get what's done. I'm selfish in the way that I want that recognition. And it's not just for me. It's to pass on, to my wife, pass on to my kid, future kids, and let them know that back in the day, we were out there and we did it. Sometimes it cost us greatly. I'm very, very thankful that I'm still here to talk about it, that I'm still able to tell my story 30 years later, even though I haven't told it probably 20 times since then. But if you've been significantly injured, the group is helpful just to read every day and see somebody else got it worse than I did, to see that somebody got the awards, that there are people wanting to help. Use that. Get that. One other thing, I know we're kind of running short on time, but at the same time, I want to say mental health is very important. And I saw tons of careers in police, fire, EMS, scuba, where people would see that significant trauma or dealing with people who had the trauma, not have it to themselves, completely lose it, give it up because they didn't get the help that they needed. Go talk to people. They can help you cope with it, help you figure it out. I'm still here 30 years later. It's been tough sometimes. It's tough when you go in and you do a job application and they call. And then my buddies call and go, hey, they called. They did a follow-up. And I knew the answer would be no. And it's different now that, you know, when I was applying for jobs, 300, 400, 500 people would take a test and not even get on the list to be called. Now I could walk out the door and get a job today at my age. But it's significantly different. Back then, they didn't want us. You got hurt, you were out. You're an outcast, and they don't want you. But get that help. Get that physical therapy, mental therapy, and make sure that you can have a career. Even if it's not law enforcement, there's a lot of other things you can do. And you know, I very much appreciate you guys. Got you up here on my wall behind me. So
I can't thank you enough for taking the time. This ended up being a really good podcast, and I appreciate it, Kev.
Oh, you're welcome. I, you know, again, if you guys ever need me for anything, call me, mess with me.
Oh, we'll bother you.
I'm waiting for the next conference. It snuck up on me the last time.
Orlando.
I can do Orlando.
All right.
When are we doing it?
April 28th through May 3rd. Let me know. Send us an email. We'll set it up.
All righty. Sounds good, guys, gals. Take care. Whatever you need.
Appreciate it, man. It's a really good podcast. I appreciate it so much.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir. I very much appreciate you.
I'll see you.
See you guys.
Hey guys, check out our upcoming training at StreetCop.com. Don't forget, we have 50 instructors nationally teaching a variety of topics. These are the best classes you're going to experience in your career. We make sure of it. You're going to love it. I guarantee you, you're going to be thankful that you went. Check us out at StreetCop.com for all upcoming classes in your area.